Working families need someone on their side in this nation.
All right. If you're just joining us, we don't have audio. Yes, we do. If you're just joining us, an event just began with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris taking the stage together for the first time. So I figured it is history. We should check it out for a few minutes.
As our next vice president. You know, it comes from people all over the country. It's already occurring all over the country, all ideological views, all backgrounds. Events, of course, we are predictable, some of them. It comes from all over, except, of course, from Donald Trump's White House and his allies. You all knew it was coming. You could have set your watches to it. Donald Trump has already started his attacks, calling Kamala, quote, nasty.
Of course.
Whining about how she is, quote, mean to his appointees.
Oh.
It's no surprise, because whining is what Donald Trump does best, better than any president in American history. Is anyone surprised Donald Trump has a problem with a strong woman or strong women across the board?
No.
We know the more is to come. So let's be clear. If you're a working person, worried about whether or not you'll have a job to go to, whether or not you'll be able to pay your mortgage, pay your rent, worried about the poison in the air you breathe, the water you drink, worried about your civil rights, even your basic right to dignity, which is under attack with this administration.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris has had your back, and now we have to have her back.
Okay, let's introduce her.
She's going to stand with me in this campaign.
Bring her on.
And all of us are going to stand up for her. On January 20th, 2021, we're all going to watch Senator Harris raise her right hand and swear the oath of office as the first woman ever to serve in the second highest office in America, in this land. And then we're going to get to work fixing the mess that President Trump and Vice President Pence have created.
Yeah, you got your work cut out for you there.
Abroad, through 4 years of mismanagement and coddling of terrorists and thugs around the world. Not only will America dig itself out of this hole they put us in, we're going to build. We're going to build back, and we're going to build back better.
Build back better.
We have a public
better
health
than
crisis.
Be best.
While he's in court trying to do away with health care.
Okay.
With more than 5 million reported infections, 165,000 people dead and climbing as a consequence of COVID-19. And still, months later, no real leadership or plan from the President of the United States how to get this pandemic under control. No real help for the states and local governments trying to fill the vacuum of leadership from the White House. No real help for children and educators, for small businesses.
All right. This is going to go on for a while. I thought we would get Kamala Harris's first remarks as the new presumptive vice presidential nominee. But, you know, we've heard Joe. It's okay, but we don't need to fill up our entire show listening to Joe. I'll keep an eye on the feed when Kamala Harris speaks. Perhaps we'll cut back in and take her comments. But in the meantime, welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thank you for joining us as always. I'm really excited for today's show because one of my favorite guests is returning. Thomas Frank is the author of so many books, from What's the Matter with George, with Kansas, to The Wrecking Crew, to Listen Liberal, to it goes on and on. He's got a brand new book out. It's called The People, Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism, as opposed to populism. But I think we'll cover both. So Thomas Frank joins us at the bottom of the hour, and for that, I'm so grateful. Stick around if you've not heard Thomas Frank. If you're not familiar with him, be prepared, because he honestly is one of my favorite guests ever. He used to come on fairly regularly when he was writing a regular column for the Wall Street Journal and then Harper's. And then he stopped doing the regular columns and he took, you know, years off at a time to write books. And so when he's writing, he's not doing interviews. So I've missed having him on the program, and I'm excited that he'll join us today. So yesterday when the show began, I had a little epiphany. I'm like, I want to do a Kamala song to Kamala to the tune of Camelot. Well, sometimes all you must do is ask and ye shall receive, especially when Lauren Mayer is in the house, as it were. Hold on. Oh, I need to mute. How do I, let me do this. Ah, because this is going to come up on that same pot. So I need to mute this audio. All right, let me do it that way. And now, with no further ado, let's check out Lauren Mayer's Kamala to the tune of Camelot. Great minds and all that.
Today we've learned what real astonishment is, inspiring us with feelings of such awe. Now we know who our next vice president is. It's Kamala. The Biden campaign will see a nice bounce now, as lots of girls and women say ta-da. At last her name we're learning to pronounce now. It's Kamala. Kamala will help Biden's appeal improve. And Kamala can even bust a move. She's not afraid to fight for working people. So strong she got tears from Brett Kavanaugh. Plus in debate events, she'll decimate Mike Pence, exposing her opponent's every flaw. Is Kamala. It's time to shake our bleak, discouraged mood off. No more will we see politics as blah. Plus there'll be steady work for Maya Rudolph playing Kamala. Kamala. Sexist attacks they try to bring about Kamala. But ambition isn't a bad thing. With her help on the ticket this November, will big Trump and his kleptocrats ta-ta. She's smart as she can be, and she'll make history. A master of trailblazing and aplomb is Kamala.
Kamala. Oh, hold on. We don't need more Kamala. We do, and I understand that while that was playing, Joe Biden regaled us with a Donald Trump imitation. What are we going to do? Igor Volsky says, was that the first time Biden did a Trump impression, or has he done that before? That was pretty great. I missed it. But Lauren Mayer, everybody, Kamala. Yeah. All right. So Biden's still speaking. One thing about the pronunciation of Kamala's name. Apparently, last night, Fucker Tarleton, see, I have a problem with names, too, couldn't quite get the pronunciation of her name down. Not that I think he tried. And a guest attempted to correct him. And here's what happened. Ooh, hold on.
Possibility.
Oh, here's what happened. Wait, I've got Joe Biden coming up on every possible input here. Okay, here's what happened last night on Fucker Tarleton's program.
Just tell Kamala Harris what to say, and she will say it. That is the whole point of Kamala Harris.
Tucker, can I just say one quick thing? Because this is something that will serve you and your fellow hosts on Fox. Her name is pronounced comma, like the punctuation mark.
Comma.
Kamala.
Okay?
Okay. Seriously, I've heard every sort of bastardization.
Okay. So what?
That's how it is. Kamala.
Okay.
Well, but I think it's out of respect for somebody who's going to be on the national ticket. Pronouncing her name right is actually not, it's kind of a
bare minimum. So I'm disrespecting her by mispronouncing her name unintentionally.
No,
so
it's intentional.
You're not allowed to criticize Kamala Harris.
Kamala.
Kamala Harris or whatever.
Kamala Harris. Whatever.
Because he can't get it right. Fucker Carlson. All right. I understand Joe Biden's delivering a hell of a speech, so let's listen in a little more.
If she disagrees, ask the hard questions.
Okay.
Because that's the way we make the best decisions for the American people.
Okay. All right, bring her on.
I got a chance to spend some time at my home today with Kamala and Doug. And I want to thank them. I thank them then, but thank them publicly for agreeing to join and take this journey with Jill and me.
Okay.
Doug, you're going to have to learn what it means to be a barrier breaker yourself in this job you're about to take on. America's first.
Again, what's going on is this is in Delaware. It's allegedly the first joint appearance between the presumptive Democratic presidential and vice presidential nominees, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. We've not yet seen Kamala.
And Ellen Cole. And we're going to get our kids together.
Okay.
To let them know what's coming.
Okay.
My grandchildren are about the age of their children.
I'm at a loss here. I'm not quite sure what to do. Do I keep rolling with Joe Biden? Because, you know,
he's always been a family affair.
For better or worse, he's our nominee. And he's the guy that we hope will pull us from the clutches of the Dump family. All right. Looks like, okay, here he's going to introduce Kamala.
I've been an honorary Biden for quite some time. You know, I came first to know who Kamala was through our son, Beau Biden. They were friends.
All right, this is nice.
They served as attorneys general at the same time. They took the same big, they took on the same big fights together. Kamala in California, Beau here in Delaware. Big fights that helped change the entire country. I know how much Beau respected Kamala and her work. And that mattered a lot to me, to be honest with you, as I made this decision. So now we need to get to work. Pulling this nation out of these crises we find ourselves in. Getting our economy back on track. Uniting this nation.
Uniting.
And yes, winning the battle for the soul of America. My fellow Americans, now let me introduce to you, for the first time, your next Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris.
Woo-hoo!
Kamala, floor is yours.
Because, you know, there's no studio, there's no audience there. So, wait, we'll give you some applause. Hold on. You know, we make do with what we have. All right, take it away, Kamala.
Thank you, Joe. As I
that
said,
little
Joe,
girl
when
was
you
me.
Called me.
Oh, sorry.
I am incredibly honored by this responsibility, and I'm ready to get to work.
All right, let's do it.
I am ready to get to work.
Let's go for the jugular
After the most
now.
Competitive primary in history. The country received a resounding message that Joe was the person to lead us forward.
Well, I don't
Joe,
know that
I'm
it'd go
so
that
proud
far.
To stand with you.
But that's good. I'm trying
so
to be positive. I'm positive
of
here.
Of all the heroic and ambitious women before me, whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible. This is a moment of real consequence for America.
That it is.
Everything we care about, our economy, our health, our children, the kind of country we live in, it's all on the line.
True.
We're reeling from the worst public health crisis in a century.
True.
The president's mismanagement of the pandemic has plunged us into the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
That too is true.
And we're experiencing a moral reckoning with racism and systemic injustice that has brought a new coalition of conscience to the streets of our country demanding change. America is crying out for leadership.
You got that right.
Yet we have a president who cares more about himself than the people who elected him. A president who is making every challenge we face even more difficult to solve. But here's the good news. We don't have to accept the failed government of Donald Trump and Mike Pence.
No, we don't.
In just 83 days, we have a chance to choose a better future for our country.
Well, anything would be better than what we've got now.
Dr. Biden.
Yes.
Thank you for the trust you've placed in me. Jill, I know you will be an incredible First Lady. And my husband Doug and I are so grateful, grateful to become a part of your extended family. And ever since I received Joe's call, I've been thinking, yes, about the first Biden that I really came to know, and that, of course, is Joe's beloved son, one of his beloved sons, Beau. In the midst of the Great Recession, Beau and I spoke on the phone practically every day, sometimes multiple times a day, working together to win back billions of dollars for homeowners from the big banks of the nation that were foreclosing on people's homes. And let me just tell you about Beau Biden. I learned quickly that Beau was the kind of guy who inspired people to be a better version of themselves. He really was the best of us. And when I would ask him, where'd you get that? Where did this come from? He'd always talk about his dad. And I will tell you, the love that they shared was incredible to watch. It was the most beautiful display of the love between a father and a son. And Beau talked about how Joe would spend 4 hours every day riding the rails back and forth from Wilmington to Washington so he could make breakfast for his kids in the morning and make it home in time to tuck them in.
All right, we've heard this story before, and it's heartening and it's wonderful. Again, I'm a little torn because I feel like I should be carrying this because it's happening right now. But it's not like they're making news. I was hoping that Kamala Harris would come out, you know, spewing venom to take them apart, because traditionally in a presidential race, once we have both tickets delineated, it's the role of the vice presidential candidate to be the attack dog. And I have no doubt that Kamala Harris will make mincemeat out of both Trump and Pence. I guess it just hasn't begun yet. This is still her, you know, I guess her reintroduction to the American stage. But what I just wrote in the chat room at Facebook is some people were, you know, less than enthusiastic. You know, someone just said, let me see if I can't find this comment. Someone said, you know, I'm still gobsmacked. She refused to protect children in the Catholic Church. Somebody said something about being underwhelmed. I'm so underwhelmed, but here we are. And I said, well, here's the reality. These are the people who are our only hope right now to get Donald Trump and his ilk out of control, to get them out of power. That's it. We have Biden and Harris, and we need to throw everything behind them because we need to get these grifters, crooks, and criminals. I know that was redundant, but you know what I'm saying, out of the White House. And yes, and Hillary says, I'm focusing on down ballot, and then yes, taking them on afterwards. So a few days ago, I played for you a video. It was narrated by Noam Chomsky, and it was put together by a group called Roots Action, and it's Vote Trump Out. That is the mantra. That is the mission statement. That is the clarion call. It's what we must do. We must do whatever it takes to get Trump and his cronies out of there. And then come January 21st, we good progressives take on Biden and Harris from the left. You know, they didn't put Medicare for All in the Democratic Party platform. That's a fight we will continue. We're not giving up. Our progressive ideals have not lessened. But right now, the mission statement is clear, and that is vote Trump out. And again, the people that we're going to be able to do it with, for better or worse, are Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. So that's the hand we've been dealt, and we will play it to its fullest. And do what we need to do. But yes, focus on those down ballot races, because look what happened in Minnesota last night. Despite the best efforts of the Trumpers and the corporate media telling you, ooh, Ilhan Omar, she's just hated. She's going to be out of there. Well, not so fast, little bucko. Ilhan Omar beat back her challenger by a huge margin. It wasn't even close. Let me see if I can't find the exact numbers I had here. Here you go. Her main opponent was this guy, Anton Melton Moe, who outraced her by more than $2 million, had the backing of, you know, the establishment Democrats. And she just decimated him. She beat him by more than 15 points. And again, she followed in the footsteps of her squad compatriots from AOC, who decimated her high profile TV anchor of an opponent who was going to take her on and get her out of there. Done. What's her name? Rashida Tlaib, just the other day, she was supposed to be defeated by her challenger. Not even a contest. And now we have Ilhan Omar, who handily won the nomination again, much to the probable dismay of the party elders, as they were. So, you know, progressives are on the rise in this nation. And and as much as Donald Trump would like to tell you that Kamala Harris is a great progressive, you know, she's one of those kind of weather vane people. She'll do whatever is necessary. And in this case, I guess that's a good thing. She'll do what we need her to do, I suppose. Yes. So there's lots more good news to come. And, you know, look, as much as my personal choice would have been different, if it were up to me, well, if it were up to me, Joe Biden wouldn't have been the nominee, but he is. And if it were up to me, the vice presidential pick wouldn't be Kamala Harris. But it is. Not up to me. That's who we have. And that's who I will get behind. And I will vote for Biden-Harris. It's actually a vote against Trump and whoever he's running with, be it Mike Pence, or knowing him, he'll dump Pence and bring in Nikki Haley, because, you know, one woman of Indian descent is the same as any other, right? That's how he thinks. I wouldn't put it past him to do that. But, you know, with Trump, you never know, because nothing about him makes sense. So anyway, Kamala Harris is still speaking. Here she goes. I'll tell you what we'll do very quickly, because we need to do this before we get Thomas Frank on. Let's take a quick break on the Progressive Voices Network. And those of us still hanging out here will continue listening to Kamala Harris for a couple of minutes. We'll be right back.
That an American dies of COVID-19 every 80 seconds.
Every 80 seconds?
It's why countless businesses have had to shut their doors for good. It's why there is complete chaos over when and how to reopen our schools. Mothers and fathers are confused and uncertain and angry about childcare and the safety of their kids at school, whether they'll be in danger if they go, or fall behind if they don't. Trump is also the reason millions of Americans are now unemployed. He inherited the longest economic expansion in history from Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And then, like everything else he inherited, he ran it straight into the ground. Because of Trump's failures of leadership, our economy has taken one of the biggest hits out of all the major industrialized nations, with an unemployment rate that has tripled as of today. This is what happens when we elect a guy who just isn't up for the job.
Yeah.
Our country ends up in tatters, and so does our reputation around the world. But let's be clear, this election isn't just about defeating Donald Trump or Mike Pence. It's about building this country back better. And that's exactly what Joe and I will do.
Okay, I believe it is exactly what she and Joe will do. And there you go. All right. The newsworthiness is there. It'll all be posted online if you want to go back and watch the event. Go for it. Let's do it. And in the meantime, are we back? Are we back from the Progressive Voices break yet? I'm not sure. Either way, I think we're back now. So welcome back. I'm a bit discombobulated because I was trying to take the live feed and all that, but I want to move on, and I'm so excited for our guest. So let me try to get Thomas Frank on the line now and tell you what I said at the beginning. Thomas Frank is, a national treasure. He is, and I see it's ringing, and now I see that he said he was ready at just a couple of minutes before five. Hopefully. There he is. All right. So I'm going to wait no longer. I'm going to get this shot set up and bring Thomas Frank into the picture. Tom, bear with me 1 second because I'm a one-woman show here, and I somehow try to do this all myself, and it doesn't always work. All right. I see your picture on the screen. Let me bring up your audio anyway. Hey, Tom Frank, how are you?
President.
Oh, Nicole
and has chosen.
I still have Kamala Harris speaking.
So good.
You're good?
Yes.
Awesome. I'm so happy to talk to you. I was telling the listeners, and bear with me, I'm still getting your picture here up on the screen. But, you know, I'm the killer multitasker of all time. So it may take me a moment, but we'll get there. I promise you we'll get there. So anyway, Thomas Frank, I mentioned earlier, I said it over and over again, you are one of my favorite all-time guests to have on this program. And I miss you when you are off writing a book because you're not as accessible as, you know, you had been prior when you were when you were writing a weekly column, for instance.
I know. Well, you know, times change, Nicole. But it is fun to I remember those days. I used to be on your show all the time.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do. I remember it very fondly, and I do miss those days. But I'm certainly glad you're here now. So Thomas Frank, the occasion, I've got your picture up so everyone can see you now. The occasion is your new book. Hold on. I got to make sure I don't have an echo on your voice.
There it is.
And I do also, I've got it up on the screen, so it lives with us. I know you can't see my video, but I promise you, the book is right in between you and me. So Thomas Frank, the new book is called The People, Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. Now, am I the first one, or is it just me? The People Know, or is it The People Know?
The People Know.
Yes.
So, Nicole, as you know, there's a famous book from 1936 called The People, Yes.
Yes.
Carl Sandburg. You see all the sticky notes.
I do. Yeah.
And there's Carl himself enjoying a nice stogie.
Uh-huh.
And it's a book length. It's like a 300-page poem about the genius of the ordinary. They called him the poet of the people, and it was a celebration of, you know, how Americans talked, how they thought, ordinary Americans. And the 1930s was chock full of that kind of populism, that kind of the decade of the common man.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all kinds of celebrations of ordinariness like that. Just think about, you know, Frank Capra movies or something like that. Tons of this sort of thing in the 1930s. And that's where I took the title from, because today we're in this situation where the legatees of FDR, the legatees of the 1930s, you know, are really not interested in ordinary people and how they think and how they do.
Right. Okay.
Cynical.
Cynicism is us. Hey, I'm the one who, my name is Sin Nicole. I often put a CY in front of the Nicole just because, you know, life brings me there. So it's in my blood. So Tom Frank, so the what I was getting out of the play on words, like the people know, Or
now
the people.
Do.
No.
Yeah. No, you are not the first one to. I'm sorry. And of course, I went off on a long.
That's okay.
I apologize.
No.
Yes, that was very clever of you, Nicole. Next question.
How my mind works. Okay, so populism. This book is about a brief history of anti-populism. But before
yes,
we can
populism
talk
populism and the people who hate it. Yes.
But before we can talk about anti-populism, we really should talk about what it is. And I think it's somewhat like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party that sort of switched places along the lines, that the idea of the populist did as well, right? The populist was the people, the people.
It's been flipped.
Yeah.
Populism was, the actual movement that called itself populism. These are the people, by the way, who invented the word. They coined it one day in 1891. Populism, the people who invented the word, it was a progressive movement. It was a movement of farmers and workers that were sort of rising up to demand fundamental changes in the economy and in the way the political system worked. This is the 1890s. Remember, it was a time of incredible concentration of wealth, extreme inequality, and monopolies. It was all that was perfectly legal was going on, and also incredible corruption, political corruption. By the way, all three things which are happening again
right
today.
Now, exactly.
Yeah, it's all with us again, and the populists were rising up to take this system on. And that's the original meaning of the word, and that was the meaning of the word right up into the 1950s, when the word was more or less deliberately flipped by a group of American intellectuals who decided that mass movements of working class people were really dangerous things, things that you did not want. Anyhow, that's the story that I tell in this book. So where does the word come from? How did the word get flipped? Why did they flip it? And then the biggest question of all, why did a wrong definition catch on in the way that it has? And so today, you open up the newspaper, you open up the New York Times or Washington Post, and the word populism always to them means racist authoritarian,
right?
Always. And it's like wow. it's completely the opposite of the people that coined the term,
right? And it's completely the opposite, frankly, of the way I think about it. And so there's a disconnect. So when I see news coverage of Bolsonaro or Duterte or Erdogan, and they talk about them as populist. Now, I don't get that. How are they for the people? How are they about the people?
Okay. Just to make you really, it's not funny. It's horrible. Right. I was watching a documentary about World War II the other day, and they referred to Hitler as a populist. Just like
what?
It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. It's like, no, the populist in that particular struggle was our guy, Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
The guy that destroyed Hitler's Germany. That's who the populists were in that fight. But we have gone such a long way down this road. But I have to tell you, writing this book was a lot of fun, untangling this mystery. And then along the way, as I did that, sort of telling the story of different populist movements in America, along the way, uncovering this other really interesting thing, the phenomenon that I call anti-populism.
Yes.
The people who hated populism in the 1890s and who still hate it today, using the same terminology, the same sort of vision of the world, of this hierarchical world that has been threatened or turned upside down by these deplorable lower class people. That vision is startling to see how it continues and gets expressed in different ways over the decades in American life.
Yeah, but so again, I go with the disconnect. I understand what you're saying, and this is what has happened in history. There has been this flip. But I look at Donald Trump. The fact that he was able to.
You look at Donald Trump and you're like, wow, yeah, look at that awesome hair.
Yeah, that's not what I say, but, you know, nice thought anyway. Look at that thing on top of his head, perhaps.
The good taste that guy has.
I just read a thing where it takes him like 2 hours every morning to do all his makeup and hair and stuff. I'm a 60-year-old woman who throws on, you know, a little bit of foundation to cover the age spots. And it's like, okay, let me do a show. It's just the ego of this man is beyond. Yeah. But that aside, you know, the fact is, this is a guy who never wanted for anything in his life. He grew up, you know, was born with a proverbial silver spoon. Yeah. He's exaggerated his wealth to make him seem bigger in his mind and others than he really is. But the same, yeah, by
like,
the same
like
token,
one of those fish that puffs itself up. You know?
But he has no clue what the average person goes through. Yet he pretends, "I feel your pain," yeah, and that's populism.
Hey, let's hand it to him. He actually did a fairly good job at that in 2016, a fairly persuasive job, or a lot of people thought he did. I don't think he's going to be able to pull it off this time.
I hope not.
You know, not with this epidemic raging all around and his bungled, incredibly poor response to it. I don't think he'll be able to make it work for this time.
I certainly hope not. And we're in the middle. That's okay. We're in the middle of this pandemic, this huge major crisis that, you know, it was one thing for him to coast along for about 3 years when we didn't have a global emergency. But once you need leadership, you realize how, yeah, you know, what horrible.
It's nice to have someone that knows what they're doing.
Exactly.
You know, it is funny that that things were able to work as well. Things worked as well as they did for the first 3 years of his administration. I mean, there were all sorts of disasters and the guy, you know, is. Are we being broadcast, by the way? So I probably can't curse, right?
You can. We're on the internet. You can say whatever you want.
Well, so he's full of shit in like so many different ways, you know. But still, we managed to sort of sort of stumble along, and to this point where before the pandemic hit, the unemployment was at this extreme low point. The economy was roaring. It was kind of weird. You know, we muddled through, and now it's like, oh my God, muddling, you know, no thanks. It would be nice to have someone that knows what they're doing in there.
Yes,
anyhow, Nicole, I hope we don't spend this time talking about Trump. He only comes up at the very tail end of this book.
Let's get back to history. So how did the flip occur? I mean, it was populism is the people. And then all of a sudden
let's start by talking about the 1890s.
Okay.
This movement in the 1890s, as I mentioned, it was a time very similar to today because there's this extreme concentration of wealth. We don't really know how extreme because this was before the income tax and they didn't keep good numbers, but the economists have tried to estimate it. And by all estimates, we're beyond the kind of concentration of wealth that they had back then. And, extreme political corruption, which goes hand in hand with extreme concentration of wealth. And of course, it was a time before there was any sort of real government regulation of anything. There were laws against antitrust, but they weren't against monopolies, but they weren't really enforced. Here comes this reform movement coming out of Kansas and the Great Plains and also the South that is demanding the government step in and make these reforms, you know, enact an income tax, take over the railroad. Go up against Wall Street, all those sorts of things. And along the way, they were the first party to demand votes for women. And they actually achieved that in several of the states where they came into power, in Idaho and in Colorado, and a bunch of other reforms like that. And the story of populism is really interesting, and I will be glad to talk about any particular detail of it that you want to hear about. But the part of the story that is so fascinating is what happened to what happened to populism, how it came a cropper.
Yeah.
And what happened is, so the 1890s, it's a depression time. You know, the economy is in a terrible state, and all of a sudden, populism, this reform movement made up of angry farmers who have been – their way of life has been being destroyed. And farmers were, by the way, close to an absolute majority of the American population at the time. And they were a disgruntled class of people. And you know, they were signing up for this movement. And then industrial workers started signing up for the movement. You know, the idea was to build a kind of labor party here in America. And the party was growing by leaps and bounds. It looks like these guys are the great coming force in American life, this populist party. And then 1896 comes along, and the Democrats meet for their convention, and they sort of throw over the sitting president of the United States, who is a Democrat, Grover Cleveland, and they nominate instead this 36-year-old guy called William Jennings Bryan, who talks like a populist and has just given this incredible barn burner of a speech about the gold standard and how we have to get off the gold standard, which was a major populist issue. The populists were against the gold standard.
Okay.
And I can tell you what, if you want to know like all the details about the gold standard, I'm the guy to ask, but you don't really need to
There's
know.
There's a reason we're not on the gold standard.
I'll just remind you, the gold standard was a really bad thing.
Right.
It was really, really, really good for bankers, but it was really bad for ordinary people. So anyhow, Brian gives this great speech denouncing the gold standard. The populists meet in their convention. This is at a time when there are three main parties in America. The populists meet for their convention a few weeks later, and they say, well, you know, he's not with us on everything, but he's with us on one really big thing. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to endorse him also. And when that happened, these two parties coming together behind this guy who appears to be a radical, the press of this country, the newspapers came together with the tycoons and the millionaires and the bankers and the academics and the clergy in what I call a democracy scare. There was a kind of a hysterical reaction to Bryan and to Bryanism. And they called him a radical. They called him an anarchist. They called him a Jacobin. They compared him to Robespierre. They thought he was, this was the French Revolution coming home to America. Yeah. They called him a repudiationist. And they attacked him in the most vicious way. And all of their attacks centered on this one basic idea, which is that what Bryan represented was the riffraff using universal democracy to try to take the power away from the people who rightfully held the power, meaning the elites, the people who ran the corporations and ran the universities and ran the newspapers. That those people, their control of America, they were in charge because God put them in charge, basically. They were at the top of the hierarchy because they deserved to be at the top of the hierarchy.
Right.
And Bryan and his people were at the bottom because, God damn it, they deserved to be at the bottom. These were ne'er-do-wells and screw-ups and,
deplorables.
Yeah, deplorables. Right. Exactly. Now you're getting it. And they kind of went ballistic against Bryan. And if you go to my website, Nicole, tcfrank.com,
yes,
I've got a bunch of the political cartoons.
You do, and they're in the middle of the book.
And
I got to tell you, I'm a sucker.
You got to see him to believe him.
I'm a sucker for books with pictures because I'm still a kid. And so I immediately saw, ooh, there's something in here when I first got the book, and I opened it up, and right in the middle, you've got an insert with these wonderful political cartoons from back in the late 1800s, which you have conveniently put on the website.
And the themes continue.
Yes.
The themes are similar
right,
from the
1890s
up to today.
That's
it's
right.
Kind of crazy.
It really
but,
is.
I've got a lot more of them on the website, like 10 or so. And some of them are just outrageous. There's one that shows William Jennings Bryan as Satan.
Wow.
incredible. There's another one that shows him as an Italian immigrant who has just knifed Lady Liberty, and she lies dying on the steps of the U.S. Treasury. It's like, what?
Wow.
What were they thinking? And, on and on and on like this. And anyhow, they in this campaign against Bryanism, they wanted a single word to describe Bryanism. And he was, as I said, the nominee of the Democratic Party. And the word that they settled on to describe it was populism. Okay, because populism was this had been this radical movement, and they didn't really care what populism actually believed. the idea was just to insult these people and embarrass them and to call them crazy, say that they were deluded, you know, that they didn't understand.
So that was supposed to be a put down of the common man.
Exactly. And that's where it begins. So you start off with two definitions. The definition number one, which is what the populists actually were and what they thought they were doing, which is building a mass movement for economic reform, a movement of working people from all different races and backgrounds. And it was something very progressive by the standards of the 1890s, very progressive. Mm-hmm. And then you have the establishment's definition of populism, which is this movement of people who are mentally ill, who are revolutionaries, who are up to no good, who are riffraff, people at the very bottom who have this resentment. The key word there is resentment. Their hatred of the system is not rational. It's just a form of resentment. There's something pathological about it. Okay.
Okay.
And then, so that's the 1890s. And, that, by the way, that was the end of the Populist Party after they signed on with Bryan, and he proceeded to lose, in this shocking defeat. They were very, they had made this gamble getting on board with Bryan. The gamble didn't pay off, and the Populist Party fell apart.
Wow.
And it disappeared. But you have a kind of renewed populism in the 1930s when all of these same themes come back into American politics, but this time triumphantly,
right?
In the form of the New Deal and in the form of the labor movement. So instead of there were farmer movements in the 1930s, of course, but there was also the labor movement, which grew by leaps and bounds, tripled in size in the course of the decade, and really revolutionized American society and the way money was the way income was distributed in this country, and made America into the great middle class society that people like you and me, who are old enough to remember, we don't remember the 1930s, but we remember when America was a middle class country.
That's
was
right.
A great sort of social democracy, and that was the doing of this kind of 1930s style populism that we started the show with. Carl Sandburg, Frank Capra, you think of the Fanfare for the Common Man.
Sure. Aaron Copland.
All of the wonderful cultural productions of that era, the WPA murals.
Yeah.
But above all, the figure of Franklin Roosevelt, who is a sort of great hero and used this populist language and got these very populist things done. He is the one who took us off the gold standard. He finally did it.
Mm-hmm.
He got farm programs passed. He did indeed come down hard on Wall Street and bankers in general, and really sort of brought this the populist program to consummation.
Right.
But that's not where the word flips. That comes later.
Okay. All right. Please, no.
I have this problem, Nicole. You know this. I will just blab.
And that's fine with me because you're doing a great job explaining it. But yet we think of FDR and the New Deal and all those programs. That is the height of populism, right?
Yes.
That's what it was about, the people.
That was the populist, the decade of the common man. It was the populist decade par excellence. And you can see it in any World War II movie, eight guys on the B-17, and they're all from these different backgrounds, but it's all about the innate wisdom of ordinary people. That is the sort of recurring theme in the 1930s. And so that's all very well known, by the way. All the sort of cultural history of the 1930s has been written about again and again and again and again. I decided to look up the people who hated Roosevelt, which is really fascinating, the anti-populists of the 1930s. And it was very similar to the 1890s, to the reaction against William Jennings Bryan.
Right.
You have once again the American establishment comes together in a kind of consensus, a kind of common front against Roosevelt. It's led this time by the National Association of Manufacturers, which is an industrial front group, by the newspapers of America. The newspapers of this country hated Franklin Roosevelt, despised him, and again economists eminent lawyers, the sort of, you know, the orthodox academia of the 1930s, all of the establishment again came together against Roosevelt and denounced him in the most ferocious, the most extreme way, and used a lot. I went and dug up a lot of their denunciations of Roosevelt, which are much easier to research now, by the way, than they used to be, because you can read all these old newspapers and pamphlets online, and stuff. Right. You can read them online.
Right.
And the way they did what we don't remember now, we remember that this happened, right? That in 1936, the powers that be came together against Roosevelt to try to put him down. And what we forget is the exact arguments that they used against him. And it was the same stuff that they had tried in 1896, that the New Deal represented an uprising of the unfit, in which people who were lazy and incompetent were trying to use the democratic process to gain the upper hand over the rightful owners of America, the rightful masters of America, the people who were in charge because they deserved to be in charge.
It sounds like the same shit they're slinging today with, exactly. Of course. So it's history repeating.
But here, the funniest part about this 1930 stuff is there's all of this racism mixed into it, to the right-wing reaction against Roosevelt, which I did not know about, scientific racism. It was called eugenics.
Okay.
And it was this whole pseudoscience about DNA. Well, they didn't know what DNA was at the time. But they would say the reason these people are in the working class is, duh, because they have bad genes.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and the reason we own industry, the reason we are in the driver's seat in this country is because we have good genes. And we were born, you know, to these people who, you know, through this process of breeding and selection and social Darwinism. It's just the craziest stuff. And can you imagine, Nicole, trying to win an election by saying stuff like that over the radio, which is what they did.
Yeah.
They would have national radio hookups and they would say crap like this. And, you know, long story short, they got their ass handed to them. Roosevelt.
I think I just lost you. There you are. I think.
Can you hear me?
Now I hear you. I lost you for a moment there. You're back.
I have no idea what's going on with this damn thing.
You're back. I got you.
Okay. So, yeah. I think I see what it is. So Roosevelt beat them in one of the biggest landslides of all time in 1936. He won every state but two. It was just a crushing defeat. And what can I tell you one of the interesting little facts about
it? Please. Yes.
A little interesting detail. After it was over, all of these people went out and studied, you know, what had gone wrong with this campaign to beat Roosevelt. What had gone wrong? And somebody pointed out that, you know, the newspaper industry was universally opposed to Roosevelt in this overwhelming way and denounced him in this incredible way. And someone pointed out that in cities – back then, a city would have more than one newspaper in it. Yeah. And they said that in cities where every single newspaper was anti-Roosevelt, that's where he got his biggest vote totals.
Interesting.
Weirdly, people were reacting not just in favor of Roosevelt, not just to announce their support for the New Deal, but they were lashing back against the news media itself, mm-hmm. against the newspapers themselves. A lesson that we might take to heart
again. I point to a song by the Propellerheads featuring Shirley Bassey called History Repeating. It's all just a little bit of history repeating. I hear it go through my head all the time, but this is, I'm sorry, please continue, because this is fascinating.
Isn't that extraordinary? And so this anti-populist campaign in the 1930s completely crashed and burned. Okay. So that's the first half of the book. The second half is when populism, when the word gets flipped, gets stood on its head. Hang on a second here. I'm going to see if I can make this damn thing work. Yes, there it goes. So the problem is, Nicole, that I sometimes can't hear myself when I talk on Skype. So I had
gotcha.
To adjust something, and now I've got it.
You're all good.
So then in the 1950s, a really interesting thing happens. And it happens. There's a group of intellectuals coming up at the time. They were called the Consensus Intellectuals. Consensus, because they believed that there was no real dissent in American life. Americans had always agreed on all the big things. There'd never been any real arguments among Americans all through our history. We were all pretty much there on the same page all along, all the time. And which is kind of a crazy idea when you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, Civil War, et cetera. But these historians zeroed in on populism as the movement that they disliked and that they wanted to denounce. There was a famous book that came out in 1955 written by a guy called Richard Hofstadter called The Age of Reform. And he was going to go back and do a new history of the period from the 1890s up to the 1930s. And the great villain of his book was the populist movement.
Wow.
And he used the tools of psychology to go back and look at populism and say, aha, you know, this was not really a reform movement. What this was it was a sort of pathological lashing out by people who were downwardly mobile, meaning farmers, that they were seeing their way of life disappear. And so they were backward looking. There was something psychologically wrong with them. They were victims of status anxiety and paranoia. And basically he went through all of the accusations that had been thrown at William Jennings Bryan in 1896 and updated them with 1950s language.
Oh, my.
Never acknowledged that he did this, by the way. He never quotes any of those sources from the 1890s. He pretends that he came up with this all by himself. He sort of reiterates all of those things in the kind of academic language of the 1950s and says that's what populism is. It is – populism is a kind of proto-fascism. When working class people get together, it's always this kind of bigoted authoritarianism. And he said populism was xenophobic. Populism was anti-Semitic. Both things which were manifestly untrue, by
sure,
the way. He was sharply rebuked on basically all of these things. And the reason he said these things was because he and his friends were very frightened in the 1950s by McCarthyism, you know, which had been this movement attacking intellectuals, calling people communist.
Right.
And for whatever reason, they decided that McCarthyism was a form of populism and that all working class movements, all movements of working class people basically would result in something like McCarthyism, in these witch hunts and this scapegoating and these dangerous things. And so the argument was that you had to reject mass movements of working class people. Those were dangerous. Those led to all sorts of awful authoritarian conclusions. And what you had to have instead was a society in which reform was brought by people like the consensus intellectuals, by people who had graduate degrees, by highly educated people, people who were supremely rational, who understood psychological theory.
The elites, and who, perhaps?
This is by – sorry, say that again.
The elites, perhaps?
The elites, right. But what kind of elites? It's managerial elites.
Right.
And remember, this is the 1950s. So this is the great heyday of the managerial elite. This is the great heyday of the organization man. And then this is when all the corporations are being taken over by MBAs. The Pentagon is being run by Robert McNamara.
Wow.
You know, that's sort of the great genius of managerialism. And Hofstadter is writing a manifesto for this generation, okay? That this is how you get reform. You get people like me, intellectuals like me. We all sit around a big mahogany table in Washington, D.C., and we come to an agreement. We come to consensus among ourselves. And that's how you get prosperity. That's how you manage an economy. That's how you get reform. That's how you fix everything. What you do not want is mass movements of working class people like the labor movement or like the farmers movement, because that only leads to all of these pathological things. Now, two things are worth have to be pointed out here. First of all, Hofstadter was wrong about populism, so his history was bad.
Mm-hmm.
His actual his actual historical work was crushingly refuted by other members of the historical profession, other sociologists.
Hey, Thomas Frank, hold that thought for just 1 second, because we're coming up on the top of the hour.
Advertisement, do we?
No, we do not. But I do need to tell the people on the Progressive Voices Network that our hour is ending, so that you can come over to NicoleSandler.com to get the rest of this interview, because it'll be posted there. So sorry, Progressive Voices, you're gonna leave us in about 20 seconds, but we're going to continue for a few minutes because we're not done yet. So Thomas Frank, I'm sorry. Continue.
I should have crammed a lot more time, Nicole.
It's all right. It's fine. I'm not going anywhere. This is fascinating.
Yeah. So this was all this. It turns out that the actual scholarship here was bad, but it didn't make any difference. Hofstadter's vision was repeated by all of these other intellectuals like Daniel Bell, Seymour Lipset, Edward Schills, many of these guys, the consensus generation of intellectuals. They all bought into this, and they started using the word populism as a generic term to mean racist, authoritarian, working class movements.
Oh, my God.
And that's where this happened. Now, as I said, it was refuted very quickly. It was shown that Hofstadter had actually got populism wrong, really wrong, like completely, totally wrong. But it didn't make any difference, because his understanding of it was so flattering to the new elite class that was coming up in those days. And so whenever you have people who believe in, remember Daniel Bell's title, The End of Ideology.
Okay.
Or Francis Fukuyama, what is it called? The End of History. Or people who write books with titles like Beyond Left and Right, or whenever people talk about this stuff, they always use the word populism as the opposite of themselves. They get this from Hofstadter, and that's where the modern understanding of it comes from.
Wow.
And the joke is that it's all based on a mistake. I mean, it's not funny.
No,
it's tragic, because it poisons. It's poisoned our understanding of the past. It's poisoned our understanding of the political possibilities before us. You know, the how do you get reform in American life? Well, you know, I'm here to tell you, Nicole, that the great managerial dream of a bunch of elites, you know, all chummy with one another, sitting around a table in Washington, D.C., that doesn't really work.
Right. Isn't that the Bilderbergs?
No, that's like where we are today. That's how DC works.
Yes, it is.
But it doesn't really deliver all those great things that people thought back in the 1950s. It doesn't really work. The examples are, there's so many of them. The Vietnam War, you know, is a sort of great triumph of the managerial elite. It was a catastrophe. The Iraq War, same thing. The financial crisis, you know, all of these professional elites agreeing with one another and driving the country off a cliff because no one could see it coming.
Right.
Or the response to it when the people in government, the elites in government, bailed out their buddies on Wall Street and didn't take any kind of measures.
No.
Prosecute or punish them or break up their banks or reform. I mean, they did do some reform, right? It was called Dodd-Frank, but it was just it was just a Band-Aid.
Right. But then you look where we are today, Thomas Frank.
By the way, the greatest elite failure in some ways, depending on how you look at it, the greatest elite failure of our time is the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016.
Huh.
Do you ever think about this, Nicole? It was managed by the greatest political consultants of our time. You know, these are the most brilliant minds in the Democratic Party. Did you hear that? There's a thunderstorm.
Oh, God. That usually happens here where I am. I'm in Florida.
We're having them every day this summer. It's so weird.
Wow.
But the campaign managed by the greatest consultants in the political game.
Right.
They go up against a guy who's never run for office before and is the most unpopular presidential candidate of all time.
Right.
And his campaign manager, Steve Bannon, has never managed a political campaign before. And these great consultants, these geniuses, this great union of the expert class, of the professional class, you know, the Hillary Clinton campaign, they lose to this guy.
Yeah.
And then they get kicked upstairs. They get nice jobs at Harvard, at Google, at, you know, Uber, whatever it is. You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It happens over and over again.
It's incredibly frustrating. And then they denounce populism.
Right.
Of course.
because they're the deplorables. And so here we are. And then you get Trump and his cronies.
At the most obvious point, which you just made, which is that this anti-populist sentiment starts on the extreme right. Okay, yes. Bankers, newspaper men, clergymen of the 1890s. These are racist individuals. These are people who believe government should never lift a finger for the poor or for people who are in trouble. They hate populism. That whole idea, their whole way of understanding this movement and working class people generally, then gets adopted by Richard Hofstadter and his friends, who are liberals. The liberal consensus. And today, this whole anti-populist sort of scheme is characterized. The people who use it now are the center left.
Right.
It's the, you know, it's like the Clinton campaign. It's the pundit bureau. Have I used that word?
You have not. But that's a good one.
My term.
I like that. Trademark that one.
The opinion class.
Yeah.
You know, the little tiny group of people here in Washington and New York that get to form our opinions for us. Right.
Right. The same 20 people.
They are the great anti-populists of our time. It has gone from right to left. It's the most extraordinary thing.
But we also have what's happening right now with the Black Lives Matter movement, with the people standing up and fighting back against police brutality. And, you know, this is a populist movement. That's how you have to describe it.
It's close to it. It's not one yet.
Okay. Why?
Well, the name is populist. Black Lives Matter there's something very 1930s about that name. Mm-hmm. You think about it. It's mm-hmm. saying, it's insisting on the humanity of the most discriminated against people in society. And I love that, by the way. Yes. I think that's perfect. But populism is traditionally a movement about economic democracy. And Black Lives Matter isn't there yet.
Okay.
But they're getting there. And I'm here to tell you, Nicole, if they the day that it does go into economic issues and start, I mean, this thing will explode. Yeah, it will become huge. And this is exactly the time when we need something like that. I mean, look at where we are. Universal healthcare is looking real good right now.
You think? Bernie Sanders is looking really good right now, but it's those same elites who kept him down. And that was a populist movement. And Bernie Sanders, and to some extent Elizabeth Warren before she kind of went wishy-washy on us, really had that momentum going. And then
the elite of the party
shut it down.
What happened to those two? It just in some ways I can't even think about it because it makes me so upset
because they
were so right and they were so with the moment.
Yep.
And then they went down, you know, fighting with each other.
Yeah.
Right before the pandemic hit. And I don't know. I mean, if you catch me on a good day, I'll say maybe Joe Biden gets it. And maybe Joe Biden, you know, Bernie likes Joe Biden. Bernie Sanders thinks Joe Biden's great.
I know.
And maybe Joe Biden will come through and will deliver these wonderful things. But I wouldn't hold my breath.
No. And with his choice of Kamala Harris, I get why he picked her. But I don't think it helps us in the goal that we have now of, you know, getting out of this pandemic, getting out of this place that we're in. And what you mentioned, you know, once the economics hit us, well, we're there. We have a huge eviction crisis waiting,
anger,
and
the
hunger.
Anger is totally there. And then you just pile that on to all the other anger that's been building over the years from the, you know, deindustrialization and the trade agreements. And, you know, I'm talking about the stuff that Trump tapped into back in 2016. A lot of which has not really gone away. And the moment is absolutely explosive, is absolutely ready for a genuine populist movement. And I would love to see it. But Nicole, I mean, I know our time grows short.
Right.
I just have to tell you, I've been waiting all my adult life for such a moment.
Yeah.
And I thought we had it in 2008 with Barack Obama.
Yeah, so did I.
And I thought we had it last year with Bernie Sanders.
So did I.
I mean, you remember when every other candidate running for the presidency in the Democratic Party was trying to sound like him. Do you remember that?
I do.
And it was this extraordinary moment. And
So what do we do now? How do we take populism back and make it work for us? How do we corral that energy, which is there? We see it out in the streets. We saw it on January 21st, 2017, the day after what's his name was inaugurated, and millions of people took to the streets, not
what's
just here, but around the world. Yeah, that thing.
One hopeful thing that Sanders understood, and a lot of other people understand nowadays, is that it's not so much about leaders; it's about the movement. It's about building a mass movement. Now, that's not an easy thing to do. That said, we all understand that, or a lot of – I shouldn't say we all understand that, because I'm about to contradict that. But a lot of people understand that it's about building a mass movement. On the other hand, and Nicole, you know this is true, so much of the energy in liberal circles these days is the opposite of movement building.
Yeah.
It's about purging,
yep,
and canceling and holier than thou, and, you know, declaring people to be deplorables and irredeemables and, you know, the sinful.
Yeah.
And can I take a step back here? Another populist moment that we didn't talk about is the civil rights movement. And there was a guy takes up a big part of my book, because there's a lot of heroes came out of that, a lot of people who understood. And one of them was a guy called Larry Goodwin. He was a civil rights activist in Texas, and he later became this great historian in the 1970s and wrote in some ways the greatest treatment of 1890s populism that's ever been written. It's very long. It's called Democratic Promise. Okay. And it's a classic. And then after he wrote that, he was a professor at Duke University, and he was working on oral history stuff. And he wrote articles about how you build a mass movement, how you build a movement like the farmers in the 1890s, or the workers in the 1930s, or the civil rights movement in the 1960s. What do you have to do? And one of the phrases that he used, and this, when I was doing my research, this phrase really nailed it for me, and it came up again and again and again. And it's not ideal, but it's the closest I've found. He said, you have to have ideological patience. Ideological patience, because the people that you're working with are they didn't go to graduate school, Nicole. They probably didn't go to college. Mm-hmm. They're ordinary people. They don't know the vocabulary. They might not be right on all, you know, on all the issues, you know. And nevertheless, that's who you have to work with. If you really want to build a mass movement of ordinary people, which in a country like ours is the only way you're going to get universal health care, the only way you're going to get some kind of real democratic reform of this economy, mm-hmm, is by building that mass movement. This is what you have to work with. This is the raw materials, and you have to practice ideological patience with these people. But we don't do that these days, Nicole. No. We go entirely the opposite direction. Our movement today, or our, such as it is, liberalism today, is all about purging and denouncing and blacklisting, even. Yeah. And that's sometimes I can't believe what where we're going. It's like Twitter has done something to our brains. We think we all think we're on reality TV, mm-hmm, and that if we can just be the most righteous one out there, we're going to win the game. You know, and everybody else gets canceled off the island, and it's just us left, and then we win. And I'm here to tell you that's not how it works.
No, but I've noticed you have succumbed, and you are now on Twitter, where you didn't used to be.
Yes. I don't want to say it. I'm not ashamed of that. I mean, you have to be. And sometimes it's fun. And there's a lot of people who are very clever, and I love reading what they have to say on Twitter. But I can't take it, really. I
understand.
I only go on there once a day. I can be on there for about half an hour, and it makes me so depressed.
I understand fully, completely.
Yeah,
I get it.
I have to.
It
involves a lot of B O U R B O N. to get me back on my feet afterwards.
Got it. Duh. I'm a little slow sometimes. I go the other way. Yeah, I go for the legal weed. But I'm right there with you. So, Thomas Frank, I could talk to you for hours, and I so appreciate your time, and I love the book.
I will do it anytime you want, Nicole. Okay. I'm at your service.
Awesome. I will call.
I got nothing else to do here except I got to mow the lawn from time to time, you know.
Well, then I will call on you again, as I used to, because I love talking to you. But I got something that I saw that I need to ask you about on your website, which is tcfrank.com, that people need to visit and explore. You wrote a blurb about the new book, The People Know. And you wrote, "The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. For my final political book, I decided to come to a reckoning with populism, the idea that has defined my career." Your final political book? What?
Yeah, well, I'm really sick of this. You know, I told you I started in the 80s. I started the Baffler magazine in 1988, and I expected Reaganism to be reversed. I thought this country was going to be like, okay, back the other direction. Here we go. And it never happened. And and I've been waiting and I've been writing about this stuff. And I feel like I have been arguing, well, they're not the same thing, but they're interrelated things. What's the matter with Kansas? Mm-hmm. Listen, liberal, and The People Know. These are all closely related. They're examining different sides of the same question. And I just feel like it's time to go back to what, you know, I backed into politics. I used to write about cultural history. Uh-huh. and that was fun, Nicole. And I want to do that again.
Okay. I get it.
That's all it is.
I get it. I used to do music radio and I miss it. I mean, politics.
Oh, my God. I used to write about music.
Right.
And when I started the Baffler magazine, the whole idea was so I was fascinated by music. I thought music was so important back in the 80s.
It still is.
And this was, you know, well, you don't want to get me started on this.
We'll do that another day. Okay.
Yeah, we had all these musicians. Anyhow, I'm still friends with those people, and mm-hmm. I want to get back to writing about them.
Good.
And their thoughts and their adventures and it's all that sort of thing.
I understand. Well, then I'm excited. I'm excited to see what comes next.
Yes, and it's not like it won't be political. You
gotcha.
Know me, but
yes.
It won't be about like Democrats and Republicans.
Well, maybe it's time to get past Democrats and Republicans.
Sure is, yeah.
And that might be the place to end this
today. I am really
at the
end of the road with both of them.
You and me both.
I mean.
Oh, my goodness. We didn't even get to, you know, the whole Biden, Kamala Harris. I mean, we are in what we're in, and we need to do what we need to do to get the orange menace out of the White House. And then the new fight begins, as I said earlier before I brought you on. Yeah. Then on January 21st.
Can I just tell you something? Like, and I know you want to wrap
No, that's
wrap
fine.
This up,
we can go as long as you want.
I am optimistic that Biden will be able to beat Trump this fall. I think he's a man that people have trouble hating mm-hmm. in a way that they found it much easier to hate Hillary
yes.
Clinton. And I don't think that'll be so much of a problem with Biden. And I think his chances are excellent for this fall. I also don't see how you bungle a pandemic the way Trump has and get reelected. I don't see how that's possible. But that said, I don't see any of the things that I've described in What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, and The People Know. I don't see these things ending.
No.
I see these things continuing and I see them getting worse. The next Trump is not going to be as stupid as this Trump. Is not going to be as such a like an open bigot, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is not going to be incompetent the way that this guy is. But the Republicans, remember, are supremely good, supremely cynical political players.
Yep.
And the Democrats are lost in this. A narcissism of their own, you know, Trump and his narcissism, the hairspray, the tan.
Yes.
The Democrats are lost in this kind of moral narcissism. They are in love with themselves and their own virtue, and they can't see past that to understand their own blunders. And I don't see that changing. They had the perfect opportunity twice in the last 20 years, Obama and then Bernie Sanders.
That's
last,
right.
And didn't do it both times. And I don't see how that changes.
No. Well, you got to hope with a new generation, and I have some good feeling. I have some confidence in seeing today's young people a little more active, more involved, more concerned with the urgency of the situation we find ourselves in, because this is their future, and they're going, you guys really fucked it up.
Yeah, you're not allowed to say that on the air, by the way.
I know, and that's why I'm not on the air anymore.
And there's a certain... And the word is disillusionment. That Obama, you know, the thing about hope is that if you don't follow through, it brings disillusionment, and that's exactly what happened. And you've got this whole young generation of people that came out of the Obama years with their hopes left, you know, unfulfilled.
That's right.
And again, I don't think Democrats understand that. I mean, but at a certain point, I don't know. They'll have to. They just have to.
They have to
get it. But anyhow, we shall see.
We shall see. Thomas Frank, you are a treasure. The book, again, is available now. The people know, get it, read it. It's awesome. Visit tcfrank.com as well and look around. There's a lot of great stuff there, especially all those cartoons. And I'm so glad that you're back among us and I can call on you again, because I will.
Anytime, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Thomas Frank. I so appreciate it.
You got it.
All right. You take care. Have a great
night.
Bye-bye. Wow. What a treat. Always a treat to talk with Thomas Frank. As I told you at the beginning, always one of my favorite guests ever, bar none, and now you know why. All right. So we're 20 minutes long. For those who missed it, just know I'll be guest hosting for Brad Friedman again this coming Friday. So I will package this interview together and have a full hour show. So there you go. So Progressive Voices will get to hear the whole thing too. You can find Thomas Frank on the Twitters at @ThomasFrank_. For years, I asked him about Twitter. He's like, oh, I'm not doing that stuff. All right. He held out as long as he could. I agree with everything he said. Our future is in the fate in the hands of the young people. And I think we're in decent shape. All right, with that, I'm done. I got to go make dinner. See you all tomorrow. Tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. We have some good stuff to celebrate. All right, keep the faith, everyone. Know we got a big battle ahead. And once, we get Trump out of there, we've got another big battle ahead. So our fight is long from over. At least we're in it together. All right, have a great night, everyone. See you tomorrow. Bye.